Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to another action-packed edition of the Between the Tackles podcast. Joe, Burge, Manish, we're ready to go, dude. We're ready to go. It was an action-packed weekend, but first, I think we have a little housekeeping to get to here. We had two coach hirings in between the podcast here. We had Harbaugh to New York on a massive deal, the Giants on a massive deal, and Stefanski, wait, did he go to the Dolphins? Wait, why am I getting it backwards?
Falcons.
Falcons. He went to the Falcons. Sorry. I knew it was
welcome
a
back, order. Joe.
I know, dude. I know. I spent the entire weekend skiing. I drove like 12 hours in the sleet and the rain yesterday. I'm all over the place, but
You must have hit that tree.
No, dude, I hit the wall. I hit the wall about like 7 o'clock yesterday. Like I was listening to the Patriots post game and I literally just like passed out, like watching TV with my earbuds in, listening to the post game. So like, I don't know. It was one of those weekends where it was like a lot, but it was worth it. Cause everything I did was fun, from skiing to like watching the Pats go to another AFC championship game.
We'll get to that in a little bit, but let's talk about Harbaugh here. I think we had talked about this on previous episodes, how this just screamed a fit with the Maras and having some sort of stability with hiring an experienced head coach after the Giants had really gone through their share of first time head coaches or relatively inexperienced head coaches. So I think it screams a fit. I thought it was interesting that the holdup over the last week was who Harbaugh was going to be reporting to, whether it was Joe Shane or it was going to be the Maras in general. And I think that they worked out a nice little arrangement there for him. I think it's a perfect fit for both Harbaugh and the Giants.
It made a lot of sense. And as you said, Berg, you know, we talked about it. As soon as Harbaugh got let go by the Ravens, the Giants were looking for stability. They were not going to go with a first-time head coach this time. And John Mara, the co-owner of the franchise, is in poor health. So I think, you know, he didn't want to mess around. He knew the guy that he wanted. I think that whole organization really put a full court press on John Harbaugh. And he didn't even have his subsequent interviews with the Titans and I believe Atlanta. Those were the top three on his list. So, you know, it was clear based on subsequent reporting as well that John Harbaugh made the Giants his top target as well. And I thought it was funny from a media perspective. You know, I'm always intrigued by how these things are covered. And the reporters who cover the New York Giants were so meticulous and thorough. It was like a step-by-step, blow-by-blow account of how this came to be. I know that there were several publications that went to the restaurant that Harbaugh and the Giants press kind of went to the night before they hashed out a verbal agreement, at least, for them to get together. Just a really enjoyable experience from my standpoint, just looking at the accounts of how this kind of transpired. Ian O'Connor from The Athletic was really on top of it from start to finish. His terrific reporting, I would recommend highly reading his stories on the Harbaugh pursuit. But yeah, perfect fit for them. The next big question, perhaps the most important question left, is who will John Harbaugh hire to be the offensive coordinator to groom Jackson Dart? Everybody assumed it would be Todd Monken. And when it's all said and done, it might be Monken who would come over from Baltimore with Harbaugh. But Monken is still getting some head coaching looks, specifically in Cleveland. So we'll see how that unfolds. But I would anticipate that you would see a Harbaugh-Monken reunion. And I think Monken actually would be terrific to help develop Jackson Dart.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect fit for the organization. You said that I think you kicked off your what you were saying about Harbaugh with organizational stability, right? They have a lot of young players. It seems like they hit on a lot of their top draft picks recently. So I think it's time for lack of a better term, an authoritarian to go in there and have all these young guys pulling in the same direction, get them all on some common goals, and kind of get the ship pointed in the right direction. We'll probably save the Harbaugh. Is Harbaugh a legitimate perennial Super Bowl contending coach? Like, we can get there another day. But I think program builder, culture shedder, I think that's what the Giants need. And I think that's the perfect fit for Harbaugh himself. We'll get to the next addition to the NFC South. We have Stefanski going to the Atlanta Falcons. I don't know how I feel about this one. I think he won Coach of the Year in Cleveland. The Falcons have coming off a year where they looked abysmal a little bit and came on at the end of the season and made the end of that season for the NFC South a little bit more interesting. But I don't know. I'm not a huge retread, keep retreading the same guy, as crazy I'm saying that as a Patriots fan, as we're going to the AFC Championship game with literally a retread. But I don't know. Stefanski is not a needle mover for me, even though he has Coach of the Year on his resume.
I think it's a perfect fit. You know, you got a young quarterback, kind of a lot of young talent on offense there. Stefanski comes from the background of being an offensive coach. He does have those two Coach of the Year winnings on his record, and I think it's a good fit. I mean, it's definitely a step up, I think, from Raheem Morris. That experience clearly failed for Atlanta down there. I think a very important piece to this is that they're retaining Jeff Ulbrich, their defensive coordinator, because Atlanta's defense was definitely you know, a really good unit last year. I remember when the Patriots play them, they end up coming off that win against Buffalo as well. So that's a big piece in terms of Stefanski building out a staff. I think that's a great thing for them.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily sexy, but I think that Stefanski will be good for Michael Penix. You know, looking for somebody who's got an offensive background who can cultivate Penix's talent. Penix has had up and down moments, hasn't really broken through after these first two seasons. But I think Stefanski can help him along. And if you know anything about Stefanski's background, he is a run-centric coordinator, coach. You know, before he got the Browns job, he really turned things around in Minnesota by switching more to a run-first type of philosophy. And he's got no better – I mean, he's got a running back who's probably at the peak of his powers here, arguably the best running back in football, in Bijan Robinson. So I think offensively – they'll move it along. And as you said, Burge, I really think extending Jeff Ulbrich to be their defensive coordinator was unbelievably smart, because that defense was humming by the end of the season. They're a peaking defense with some nice young pieces. I like the fit. It's obviously an extremely weak division historically, so it would not surprise me if Stefanski pulled a Mike Vrabel and turned things around pretty quickly down there. But again, you have to look at your options. Do you want the unknown? Do you want a first timer, or do you want somebody with experience who was, let's face it, kind of in a terrible situation from an organizational standpoint, being in Cleveland, you know, a radioactive place to say the least. So I like the hire. We'll see, how it unfolds. But I think that Stefanski can be good for Michael Penix.
It's hilarious that the only guy to keep his job there is Ulbrich, and it was at the beginning. Wasn't it before the season started? His kid called Shadur, and everybody thought he might get canned because of all that BS. So it's funny how that's like the only guy standing there. I guess it's not funny. That's not funny at all. Prank calls are not funny. We're not talking about it. Anyways, so we're enough with the hirings. Let's get to the firings. McDermott gone, axed in Buffalo. I think everybody saw this coming, even with the comeback win versus the Jaguars. Everybody, it still felt like his seat was on fire going into this game at Mile High. We'll get to kind of how the game played out maybe in a second here. But give me your thoughts on McDermott. I see him more as a scapegoat, but I don't think I don't have any ammo in the chamber here to defend him as a head coach anymore. I mean, there's some idiotic plays at the end of that game. He doesn't have his team disciplined enough to kind of weather the storm at the end there. So I don't know. Just doesn't seem like he could get it done even with like one of the best quarterbacks in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, where I sit, I mean, I view it primarily as a scapegoat, given how the things transpired today. We'll talk about that when we talk about the game. But let's face it, I don't think he's all that great of a coach. I've been kind of saying that for a while, and you know, they've kind of reached their peak with what they can do there. I mean, he's had multiple opportunities to get over the hump, and it's honestly probably one of those moves that's just, you can't get over the hump, and it's time for a new voice in the room.
Yeah. Cause if you look at him on paper, I mean, he's got a 662 winning percentage over 9 seasons, which is ridiculously high, you know, consistently double digit wins. The Bills are one of 4 teams in NFL history in the Super Bowl era to win at least one playoff game for 6 consecutive seasons. Unfortunately for Buffalo, the other 3 teams won 3 Super Bowls, Cowboys, Patriots, and Chiefs, whereas the Bills have not even gotten to one Super Bowl. So it's about coming through in the biggest moments, because statistically on paper, he looks like an exceptional coach. I believe during that 9-year run in Buffalo, if you include the playoffs, the Bills had were top 5 in total points scored, which is exceptional from an offensive standpoint. And I think they allowed the 3rd fewest points defensively. So on paper, you would think, how could you let that guy go? But if you watch the Bills over the past decade, you saw the disappointing losses time and time again. The last five playoff losses included four games in which they blew fourth quarter leads, and the other loss that they had was a blowout against Cincinnati at home. So they just haven't delivered in the biggest moments. Now, what I will say to Sean McDermott's credit, and this shouldn't be overlooked, he took over a moribund franchise. He took over a place that had not made the playoffs in 18 years, and he turned them into a relevant organization, a consistently high-end team that won five division titles in his 9 years, and a Super Bowl contender. But they did not deliver when they got to that next level in the postseason. It reminds me, you know, just going back a couple decades to what Tony Dungy did in Tampa Bay. Hall of Famers all over the place on defense just could not get over the hump. And then John Gruden comes in with Dungy's players, and he goes on to win a Super Bowl. So I think the Pegulas made the right decision. It's a tough choice because it's not as if McDermott is a poor coach, but when you give a guy almost a decade to prove his worth when he has who I believe is the second best quarterback in the last decade and currently the best player in the NFL, you got to, you know, make a hard choice. And I think that's what ownership did. I'll be fascinated to see who Josh Allen teams up with now. But again, it's not as if they had a quick trigger. They're, you know, they gave Sean McDermott plenty of time with a superstar, legendary type quarterback, and he just did not get it done.
Now, it's funny that you say that you make the Tony Dungy to Gruden analogy, because I think that's when you said who it's interesting who looked, I think that's the perfect pick. John Gruden, he's a hard ass. He's great with quarterbacks. I think that's exactly what you need. I think JA needs a little bit more of a, I don't know. McTurk, like you made a really good point. The 18 years without a 18 years without a playoff berth or win, and then they're perennial. I mean, they're perennial Super Bowl contenders, like whether they're getting through the rounds of the playoffs or not, but they're consistently high up in the Vegas odds. They're consistently picked as one of the best teams, power rankings and on ESPN and all the talking heads and stuff like that. Most of that is Josh Allen, his abilities. Yeah. But you've seen teams that have like mediocre seasons. I mean, look at KC. They had an underwhelming season. They missed the playoffs. Look at the Ravens. They have an underwhelming season and they missed the playoffs. So he was able to kind of avoid those bottoming outs. But yeah, I don't know. They need a quarterback. They need a head coach that's going to take that quarterback over the top. I think that should be kind of the only thing. Like you said, it should be up to Josh Allen and the Pegulas to like make a great pick, because I think he's a big piece of this. His personality has to fit with the head coaches. It has to be a good mix, I think.
You know, there's another element to this, which I thought was pretty interesting. Not only did they not part ways with Brandon Bean, but they promoted him to director of football operations. He's actually going to oversee the head coaching search process. And when you look at what a general manager's job is, it's acquiring talent through free agency and the draft. And since Josh Allen was drafted in 2018, Bean has drafted 56 players. Only two have made the Pro Bowl. One of them is James Cook, who is a bona fide star player, and the other is Dawson Knox, who, yeah, he made the Pro Bowl 1 year, but he's kind of a marginal player. So if you look at the talent that has been acquired for Sean McDermott, it really, you know, it hasn't been a home run, to say the least. So Bean gets an opportunity to hire his head coach. Remember, he did not hire Sean McDermott. McDermott was there first, so he'll get a first crack at hiring his own coach now.
I find it fascinating that they promoted him, because if you look around at everything this year, what was the biggest complaint of not just fans, but you hear it from the media, they did not give Josh Allen enough. Look at the wide receiver position. They play him with nobodies. And it's that sense. And I hear them promote Brandon Bean. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, if you're going to find a scapegoat, you kind of got to make both of them the scapegoat for what happened this year, in my opinion. I think if they really want to fix the team, they got to get more talent in there. And the general manager is the one that brings it in.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, Birch, because I want to read off a list. These are the receivers that the Bills have acquired since 2024. Josh Palmer, Curtis Samuel, Brandon Cooks, Gabe Davis, Elijah Moore, Mac Collins, Mecole Hardman, Tyrell Shavers, Laviska Shenault, Quintez Cephas, Chase Claypool, Marcus Valdes-Scantling, KJ Hamler, and Jalen Virgil. That's what they gave Josh Allen the last 2 years.
Hey, that's Super Bowl champion Martez Valdes-Scantling, all right?
Right. Yeah.
No, it is. We joke about Josh Allen a lot, like in and out of the group chat on this podcast. But like it is a small bit of malpractice. I get on here and beat the drum about Joe Burrow and no offensive line in Cincinnati, and it's unfair not to bring it up for Josh Allen. It is unfair not to have that talent around them. And I think it just goes to show. I mean, there were some Keon Coleman drops in that game. I know he ends up with the touchdown, but there's some Keon Coleman drops in that game that are just like, they spent a first round pick on this guy. They're depending on this guy. And this is Josh Allen's only hope. Like, if that's your only hope, you're in a world of hurt. But let's get to the game that Keon Coleman scored that touchdown in. We got Broncos 33, Bills 30 in overtime. This is a pretty exciting game. Went back and forth. Both teams turned the ball over. Josh Allen puts the ball on the ground five times, turns it over four, or picked off twice, puts the ball in the ground three times, two recovered for a turnover. But I don't think we can start anywhere besides that final drive and the back-to-back pass interference penalties. You get the game, they let the boys play all day, and then the flags come out at the most inopportune time. So I know, Burge, you have a little bit of a feeling on at least the first call.
I just think it's funny because going back, I was texting with you, and I literally sent you, really love how the refs have kept the whistles away in this game. Yeah. It's been phenomenal. And the next play was the play of that first pass interference and that roughing the passer call. That first pass interference, the way the game was called, should not have been flagged for pass interference. And at the end of the day, it didn't matter because Joey Bosa is an idiot and decided to, you know, hit Nick Bosa, Bo Nix late. So I think it was a difference of 2 yards had they accepted the roughing the passer penalty. So that one is, you know, it is what it is. And the second one, he was starting to tackle him before the ball was even there. So like, I can understand why they threw it. I just hate that such a fantastic playoff football game. This is what we're talking about. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about the last second flag, even though that's pass interference all day, right? That's pass interference all day. It's called. And it just happened to be at the time of the game where it ends up deciding it in overtime. Now, go ahead.
That first one, I agree. I don't know if that should have been called. Doesn't really matter because of the roughing the passer call. Whatever. The second one, all Tre'Davious White has to do is turn around and play the ball. That's all he has to do. Like, if you see a receiver slowing up, instead of running into him and tackling him, at least try to get your head up and try to, like, at least play the ball. I think that's what the ref is looking for there. But regardless, it sucks coming on here and talking about the ref start. Like, first of all, you know what I mean? There's Josh Allen legacy components to this game. That coach gets fired. There's what happens to Bo Nix after the game. There's an unprecedented. I don't think they've had somebody start the divisional round and then have a different quarterback in the conference championship since like 1982. So we're going on what, almost 40 years, over 40 years of like that not happening. So there's so many things going on. But once again, the refs come up, and I think that it's not their bad calls, it's not their good calls, it's that they're inconsistent calls. If you're not having that all game, all we want is consistency. And I feel like that the NFL referees are in it, they're put in a difficult spot regardless. But I think that all the fan is craving is consistency.
Yeah, look, I'm gonna take an opposing view here. I understand what you were saying, Burge, about, you know, you're not calling it, and you said it too as well, Joe. You're not calling that during the game. Maybe you let that go. And that kind of falls under the umbrella of like, let the players decide the game. I've never really subscribed to that theory, because if it's a penalty, it's a penalty, regardless of whether you missed a call, you know, a quarter earlier, or if you missed a call in the first half. If a penalty occurs in crunch time and you don't call it, that to me just compounds the ineptitude. So to not call a pass interference, a clear pass interference in my mind, which is what Tre'Davious White's, you know, play was, would be just kind of doubling down on screwing up earlier. Now, that first pass interference, I'm with you guys. Yeah, ticky-tack. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter because of the Bosa penalty. But that Tre'Davious White call, I thought was the right call. You know, my problem isn't with the inconsistency about whether you're going to let guys play or whether you're going to be really tight with your flags. It's more about what the message is throughout the game. And I think there's a bigger storyline other than those two DPIs. And that's the Brandon Cooks catch or no catch, which we can get to in a minute. But when I look at this game, I say, look, I don't have a problem with the two DPIs that they called against Buffalo in overtime. I have a massive problem with the DPI they did not call against Denver on first, I believe it was first and 10 on the Denver 32 at the end of regulation when Josh Allen threw a deep ball on the right side to, I believe, Brandon Cooks, you know, at the end zone, 1 yard line, whatever it was. The defender clearly was holding his left arm down, and that was the most obvious DPI, I thought, of the game, and that didn't get called. If he gets flagged, you know, there's whatever, 15, 20 seconds left, and the Bills have the ball in regulation at the 1 yard line, you can make a reasonable case that they would win the game in regulation. That's not to absolve Josh Allen, and we'll get into that as well. He made his fair share of mistakes. He stunk, frankly, on a number of different occasions. But in terms of the DPIs, just because you missed a call earlier in the game doesn't mean that you should just be lax down the stretch. Hell, you know, the Philadelphia Eagles lost the Super Bowl because of a holding penalty down the stretch to the Kansas City Chiefs, and that was the right call. The Eagle player made a mistake. It was properly officiated. So don't have a problem with that. It's unfortunate that the Bills' defense, frankly, screwed up in those moments. But, hey, they screwed up, and Denver was the beneficiary of that.
And all right, I'll just say that real
sorry,
quick.
Go Bears.
You know, with the officials, too, I mean, there were some, two or three blatant holds that were missed. One was in the end zone, which would have ended the game in overtime, Denver would be playing with Bo Nix this week. Like, that's the kind of implication that these plays have when these calls are missed. Now, they were clearly letting them hand fight and do that all game. So, like, I don't have a problem with them, specifically when it comes to, like, holding, because I feel like if you talk to any of these guys, like, there's holding on every play. Like, they could call holding on every single play, you know, in the trenches there. So, like, I don't have a problem necessarily with that at all. So, like, that's where I come from when I want to see these guys play. Let them play.
Yeah, and I think that's where I come from too, Burge. But Manish, I totally agree with you saying. Like, if it's a game deciding play, somebody committing a penalty is also a mistake. You know what I mean? That's a mistake that should be punished. Like, committing a penalty is a mistake that should be punished. And just because you're letting people play all game doesn't mean you shouldn't punish the mistake just because it decides the game. And I agree with that. I totally agree with that point of view. The one call I did totally agree with was the interception on Brandon Cooks. I think that you got to survive the ground. He does. He catches the ball. He gets 2 feet down. He does not survive the ground. I think the defender has the ball, his hand on the ball before they go to the ground. If that's not true, if Brandon Cooks is going to the ground with the ball and gets on the ground with the ball before the defensive back is interacting with it, I think you have kind of a different story to tell here. But in my opinion, I like interception as the call there.
I do too. I thought it was for sure an interception, simply because you have to survive the ground in the process of the catch. The process of the catch for Brandon Cooks was him falling to the ground. So that was part of the catching motion. I've seen so many people trying to compare this play to what happened with Davante Adams last night in Chicago. It is a completely different play. Davante Adams, you know, we'll get to that catch later. I won't go into that. But the fact that Brandon Cooks at the end of this play did not come up irate saying that he had the ball.
They're like, oh, I effed up, dude.
I screwed up. Like, he clearly, you could clearly tell if Brandon Cooks is catching the ball with no defender around him and he hits the ground and the ball comes loose and hits the ground, it's an incomplete pass, regardless of him being touched down after. So, like, clearly the ball was moving when he hit the ground. It's not like he just went in and he whipped it away. Like, it ended up in his hands as he hit the ground. So that's where I draw the difference between those two plays that occurred this weekend.
All right. Well, I'm going to say that was 100% a catch. It was not an interception. I love the terminology that the NFL puts out, you know, possession, control, surviving the ground, through the ground. This is what I saw. This is my interpretation. Obviously, I'm not alone in this interpretation. He caught the ball. His knee was down. The defender had a hand on part of him and the ball. So it's not as if he had 100% of the ball. The defender did have his hand on it. He obviously didn't have any kind of grip on it, but he had some fingers on it. And then Cooks rolled onto his back, and when he was on his back with his shoulder blades on the back, he had control of the ball. Now, did the defender have a hand on the ball? Yes. But to me, the play ends at that point. The fact that he had subsequent rolling back onto his chest is extraneous movement. obviously the NFL disagreed with that because they believe that the process of the catch apparently includes catching the ball, having your knee down, rolling on your back, and then rolling over to your stomach. That's all part of the catching process, to which I would say that's a faulty premise, because every explanation that you've got in defense of it being an interception has been, by, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially by rule, it was not a catch. And I would counter that by saying the premise is faulty, because I look at it as by rule, it was a catch, because the process of the catch was him hitting the ground with his knee and then hitting the ground, rolling onto his back. That's surviving the ground. Now, did he survive the subsequent roll onto his belly? No. But at what point is the process of the catch completed? Does he have to do a 360 roll? Is that it? Is 180 not enough? I mean, it's so nebulous that I think you can make a reasonable case either side. And I think over the last several days, you've seen both sides kind of make passionate cases. I just think that it's such a big call, and the consternation from the side that believed it was a catch was not only that they believed it was a catch, but the fact that the league was so seemingly cavalier about their evaluation and review of it. And the pool report after the game from the officials, I believe it was the pool report, it might have been from the NFL subsequently, but from some NFL authority, was that they wanted to, quote unquote, move the game along, as if speeding the game up to move on to the next play was paramount in everybody's mind, which it wasn't. Like, I don't think anybody cared. At that point, you just wanted to get a thorough evaluation. And if, in Sean McDermott's case, a thorough explanation as to why things had moved along so quickly, because at the very least, whether it's you guys thinking it was an interception or me thinking it was a catch, I don't think any of us would have objected to them taking a good hard look. Because you see, like, relatively inconsequential plays take three times as long to review.
That's one you got to circumcise the mosquito on. That's a deciding factor. It's a big game. Like, there's no reason to not take an extra couple minutes.
They looked at the Devontae Adams one last night.
Yeah,
in Chicago. So I totally agree with that. That they should have taken more time to look at it, because it seemed like it was just right on. And Sean McDermott took a timeout right after that play, hoping that they could do that. So I don't know what went on in the back end at that point, but you say what you want about that,
dude. And friggin' Gene Steratore who did this game, dude. He's just he's like, whatever the ref calls is right. I'm actually not watching the game. I'm actually facing away from my TV. So whatever you see on the call, just go with it. Definitely, they're right. I'll see you at halftime. And it's like, all right, Gene. It's like, you stink, dude. But the only thing I want to say is, my last thing about this is, I think that if that wasn't called that way on the field, they have a lot harder time defending it. If it's called the other way on the field as an incomplete or a catch for Brandon Cooks, I think there's more credence. Like, I think the call on the field has, I don't know if they went away from this, but they got to prove that it's not true. It's not like they have it's not like it needs to be 51% one way or 49. Like, you need to prove that the call on the field was wrong. I like that precedent. I like giving giving the credence to the on-field refs, but I agree. Like, you got to take more than 5 seconds to, and like, making the team that's trying to get the play reviewed, like, use one of their crucial resources, timeout, in a close game. Like, that's just, I don't know. It's a bad look for the NFL. And with all this gambling crap going on everywhere, like, you should be even more sensitive to making sure that you get the call right, and that you're doing your due diligence to make sure that there's nothing that. Obviously, there's no plays on the field that are called incorrectly. Doing whatever you can. Outside of that, that wasn't Josh Allen's only interception. He had a pretty bad one. He had another pretty bad one. I think this is classic. One team just plays a little bit better and is able to eke out the win. Josh Allen did whatever he could. I think sometimes that works against him. I've said it a couple times before. I think sometimes him doing whatever he can works against him. One of those fumbles where he's like 5 yards past the line of scrimmage, doesn't have the ball tucked away, just trying to do a little bit too much. Doesn't take anything away from him as a player. He's a great player. Eventually he will win a Super Bowl. Eventually he will win the big one. But I think right now, with how that roster is currently constituted, I think it's in his head now, and he thinks he has to do too much, and he freaks out a little bit in these big games.
Yeah. Go ahead, Birch.
No, I was just going to say, like, that, whether that was all him at the end of the half, or, the play call came in for them to try to run something to try to get into field goal where they have like 20 seconds left or something like that.
Didn't they run a hook and ladder later in the game too?
Yeah. But like Josh Allen scrambling, I don't think they had any timeouts, or if they did, they had little, but they had to go a mile to get to anywhere that they could score points. I mean, that 3 points ends up being the difference if you look at it at the end of the game. And you know, to me, that was inexcusable. And as much as it was, is I'm going to sit here and rag on Josh Allen for not putting the ball away and protecting the ball and trying to do too much. What was up with them actually trying to do something there? Like, to me, it made absolutely no sense. You're in a very tight, close game, and it was just a completely unnecessary play, and it gifted the Broncos 3 points.
Yeah, look, I don't have a problem with them like trying to see what happens on first down. I don't remember if they had a timeout or not. So I'm not gonna blame McDermott on that. You have Josh Allen. We've heaped praise on Josh Allen endlessly. I mean, I certainly have for forever. So if you have a player of that caliber, I don't think it's, you know, egregious to kind of, you know, for lack of a better phrase, go for it there instead of taking a knee. The problem is that Josh Allen was loose with the ball. It was just a terrible decision. He was so careless with the ball, the way he held the ball. That's 100% on Josh Allen. It's a critical mistake. I mean, you don't know how the second half is going to unfold. You know, after the game, you can say, look, they lost by three. That was a gift field goal. But you don't know how the game's going to unfold in the second half if that didn't happen. Either way, egregious. I mean, that's a rookie mistake. That is not a NFL MVP mistake. I mean, NFL MVPs don't make mistakes like that. They shouldn't. And he was extremely careless with the ball. So it was a terrible decision. It was 100% his fault, not nobody else's fault. And look, he takes chances. He makes mistakes because he takes so many chances, and he's, you know, prone to making mistakes when you take more chances. And he feels like, as you said, Burge, he feels compelled to, you know, maybe take those chances because he feels like he needs to do everything. It's not an excuse. I mean, sooner or later, you have to win these games. And even if his team isn't as good as it was last year or the year before, at some point, and we've said this about Justin Herbert to a smaller degree, at some point you have to overcome that and not only carry your team in the regular season, but carry your team. And maybe it's just being overly harsh. Maybe I am. I don't know. I just know that Josh Allen has had a large sample size now, where when you have a path here where you got to beat a Broncos team that's solid on defense but has no difference making quarterback, even if you're on the road, you got to win. And maybe I'm putting too much on his plate, and maybe that's unfair. But sooner or later, I mean, he's almost 30 years old, maybe he is 30. Sooner or later, you do have to overcome that if you want to be recognized as a champion. You know, he's a lot of great things. I think he's a future Hall of Fame player. He's a dynamic player. He's an NFL MVP. But the one thing he is not is a champion. And you know, at some point over the next 5 to 7 years, he's going to have a circumstance where it's less than ideal, and maybe it's unfair, but he's going to have to carry them over the hump.
Yeah, and that's what players of that caliber are for. That's what NFL like quarterbacks that caliber are for, right? You build a roster to get you there, and then in the clutch moments, you still need a guy to pull the trigger. You look at Jimmy Garoppolo in the Super Bowl a couple of years ago. That team is a juggernaut. Gets to the final quarter of the final game, and he can't complete the pass. Like, it doesn't matter how good the team is. You still need, even no matter how much crap we talk about this on this podcast about Jalen Hurts, dude, still had to complete the passes and run the offense to win that Super Bowl. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know where you go from here for Buffalo if you in terms of head coach, but I think unlocking Josh Allen in those moments is paramount. You guys have anything else you want to say about this game, about Bo Nix, about anything like that? I have a little bit of breaking coach news if you guys want to hit it real quick between games.
Hit the sound. Let's do it.
Eric Bieniemy going back to the Chiefs as offensive coordinator. So I think interesting hire to me. It's very interesting hire after Matt Nagy takes an absolute flame. It was Nagy, right? Took a flamethrower to that offense. So good to have the guy that was actually successful back.
We'll see. You know, that's actually that's fascinating because so Nagy's on an expiring contract. He's also a finalist for the Titans job. He knows the Titans general manager, Mike Borgonzi, from their time in Kansas City. So I'm wondering if the thought here, and obviously Andy Reid and Mike Borgonzi talk, and Nagy, the three of them, you know, talk. So I'm wondering if it's a foregone conclusion that Nagy's going to be the next Titans head coach.
Yep. So you made a friggin' nail on the head, dude. So the second part of this report from the Score here, Bieniemy spent five seasons with the Chiefs, blah, blah, blah. His reported union with KC comes with offensive coordinator Matt Nagy being tabbed as the finalist for the Titans head coaching job. So, yep, I think that you hit the nail on the head there. So maybe that coaching, that hire probably points to more than just one hire, like you said, with the Chiefs' former OC, Matt Nagy, probably ending up being the head coach of the Titans there. But Burge, where do we want to go next? We're going in chronological order. So who played?
Seahawks, Niners.
Seahawks, Niners. What an absolute friggin' electrical substation of a game, dude. This was over in the first 5 minutes, dude. I shut this off with like
over
5 minutes.
First 10 seconds.
Yeah, I just shut it off, dude. It was just an awful football game, dude. They have guys that are going to be running IT departments, running out there as linebacker for San Fran, dude. There was absolutely no way they were going to win that game.
Yeah, I mean, Rashid Shaheed starts off the game with the kick return for a touchdown, and that was all. They could have scored nothing else the rest of the game, and they would have won. They could have won the
game.
That's
amazing, you know? Isn't that funny? That's 100% true. That's all they needed to win the game.
It's incredible.
10 seconds of Rashid Shaheed running at like 25 miles an hour wins the game.
It's wild. Yeah, Seattle, you know, was in control. I turned it off too. I turned it off at halftime too. I'm like, this game's a blowout. It's over. One of the few games that was kind of a nothing burger for a casual fan to want to see a good football game. But yeah, Seattle's scary, man. I mean, it's going to be a fantastic NFC Championship game coming up there in Seattle. I think one thing to note that after this game, it's kind of a pretty significant loss for Seattle going forward is Zach Charbonnet, you know, tearing his ACL. He's out. So Seattle's really done a lot with the kind of the two-headed monster running back with him and Kenneth Walker this year. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Kenneth Walker had himself a day in this one. So, you know, and obviously Seattle's defense not allowing a touchdown to Brock Purdy is impressive as well.
Kenneth Walker, fantasy owner, that was a horrifying stat sheet to wake up to in a playoff game that earned you absolutely nothing. But I'm going to be devil's advocate here. Dude, this does not change my opinion on the Seahawks, dude. But friggin' Sam Darnold had to attempt 17 passes and they scored 50 effing. Oh, they scored 41 friggin' points. So I think, I don't know, but I'm not so. I want to see Seattle. I want to see them have to throw the ball to win a game. I want to see at least have to try, at least flex a little bit, dude. They just like, this is one of those games where it's just like you see like a horse with a fly lands on its ass and it just like, just absolutely uses it with its tail, just flicks it right off, like absolutely like it's nothing. So I want to see Seattle get tested. I want to see them go back and forth with the Rams, kind of like they did at the regular season finale between them two.
Yeah, I think the biggest surprise for me, because you knew going in that Robert Saleh was dealing with a you know, shorthanded defense because of all the injuries, and you knew that Kittle on the other side wasn't playing. But I'm stunned, frankly, that over the course of 3 weeks, Kyle Shanahan offense totaled just 9 points, 3 field goals against Seattle in those two games. It typically doesn't happen. That just rarely happens where Kyle Shanahan doesn't figure things out the second time around. But you got to give McDonald's defense a lot of credit. They shut down Purdy, really a non-factor. He had no touchdowns and 2 picks in those 2 losses to Seattle. Christian McCaffrey, who almost had a 1,000 season this year, had a total of 102 yards in the 2 games, another non-factor. He only combined for 2.9 yards a carry in those 2 games, so they completely erased him as well. I'm stunned. I really thought the offense would be able to put up more points, you know, even without Kittle. They were just completely neutralized, just like they were a couple weeks ago. And you know, we've all talked about Seattle for 4 months. In the beginning, we were like, "Well, they're getting kind of overlooked. They might be the real deal. They rise up to maybe maybe they were number one in our power rankings at some point." But then, kind of dip down and say, "Yeah, are they actually for real? Do you really believe in them?" But what we've seen over the past few weeks is that their defense, you know, coming off that bye, but even at the end of the season, you know, their defense is the real deal. It's a championship caliber defense. You know, I think, you know, now that the Texans are out of the way, they clearly are the best defense left in the, you know, in the playoffs, better than Denver. And that might be good enough to carry them to a win against the Rams. And what I will caution, and you know, we'll get into this on a subsequent podcast, Sam Darnold has had his fair share of challenges against the Rams. They've done a really good job kind of stymieing him. So, you know, we'll see what the third matchup brings. But yeah, for this game, complete laugher, complete snooze fest. they looked dynamic running the ball, and they looked unbelievable shutting down Kyle Shanahan's offense.
So you wanted to know about the power rankings. They were the number one ranked team for the last 3 weeks of our power rankings. But I think that we made them earn their stripes. And like classic Joe hater fashion, they got to earn a little bit more stripes. I'm moving the goalpost. Don't care. But dude, that and what everybody said about the Texans defense is true. We'll get to that. But what everybody, I think the Seattle defense is just as scary. And the Mets makes it scarier is you got to go there one more time to try to knock them out before they make the Super Bowl. That stadium, the one thing I did stay up for and didn't turn off is that stadium was loud, dude. That dude, there's nothing cooler than when the play is happening on the field and the friggin' camera is shaking and you could see the camera shake as they're trying to record Shahid running down the sidelines, just freaking going like this, dude. Like it's at the old Boston Garden, like it's at the New York Garden, it's at the Madison Square Garden when somebody hits a big three. I love that shaking, dude. That place was rocking. Place was absolutely rocking. We'll see. We'll see what the Rams can do up there. That'll be an interesting game. But to get to another turnover fest, like we talked about in the first slot here in that Buffalo Broncos game, let's talk about another turnover fest here. The Patriots take down the Texans, punch their ticket to the AFC Championship game. Drake May throws an interception in the end zone on a Hail Mary, turns the ball, puts the ball on the ground way too many times. But the Patriots defense is the one I think is the story here. Milton Williams even said that everybody was talking about their defense. Everybody talking about the Texans defense gave the Patriots a lot of motivation. And I think it's that time of year where you need to draw motivation for wherever the heck it comes from. You need to lock in with your boys and you got to have some kind of common enemy. And this week it was the media just talking about the Texans. I love it, man. Survive in advance, whatever it takes.
The Crisco is out. We're going back to the AFC Championship game, baby.
Yep.
No, I'm right there with you. You know, the Patriots defense, outstanding. The only touchdown that they gave up in this game was as a result of a turnover. It was a short field, which is just fantastic. You know, the pressure that they were bringing on C.J. Stroud, couple that with the four interceptions. You know, say what you want about C.J. Stroud. Clearly was out there in no man's land in this game. I know we were talking a little bit offline about whether or not that D'Amico Ryan should have sat him down in the second half of this game to at least give Davis Mills a look. I'm in agreement with that based on how that first half went for him. He was just out there. He looked completely lost and that team had no juice offensively. I mean, it was shown at the end of the game where D'Amico Ryan's with 4 minutes left with one timeout decided to punt the ball back down two scores. It kind of just goes to show you that D'Amico Ryan's like, I have more faith in my defense to get a score than I do in my offense. And obviously that didn't happen. The Patriots win. Drake May, definitely concerning to see how much he's fumbling the ball. What did he fumble? Was it like four times in this game? I think it was four. And lost one only. I think he only lost one of them, right?
Sure.
Might have lost two of them. Lost two of them. Okay. Which is fortunate that he didn't lose any more to this defense. And my other level of concern is on Will Campbell. He got absolutely destroyed.
Dude,
on the
I was
left side
say
of the line.
That. I was like, I think the most alarming part about this game, I don't care what it is, it's Will Campbell, man. As soon as he goes up against legitimate like competition, whether it's the two guys in this game and Khalil Mack in the first game, like he looks like a rookie. I know he's short. I know his inside leg is hurt, which is a very important part of the body for left tackle. But if you don't draw concern from that, you're just sticking your head in the sand.
Yeah, like I think he's definitely still dealing with something. Like he's clearly not.
Has to be
100%. It has to be. Otherwise, there's some real concerns about what he can do at left tackle for the Patriots, you know, for the future years. But at the end of the day, outstanding throw, outstanding catch by Kayshon Booty to kind of ice this game at the end at a time when they really needed it, where they, you know, the Patriots offense was not particularly great in this game. They could not, they had all these turnovers and they couldn't do anything really with it. Which was very alarming. Credit to the Houston defense as much there. We all know what they are. They're kind of a generational type defense with what they have over there. But at the end of the day, the Patriots needed to do more on those turnovers. They did enough to win. Kind of like what I said last week, they're going to kind of grind it out, do enough to win. And they were able to do that, you know, largely in part because of what the defense did.
Yeah, I honestly, I feel
bad. Oh, we got breaking news in the NFL. Hold on. Breaking news. The Dolphins are hiring Jeff Hafley as a replacement to coach Mike McDaniel. So Jeff Hafley hired in Miami. He was the Packers defensive coordinator, right? Formerly with BC. So hired in Miami by owner Stephen Ross.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good connection because their new general managers came from Green Bay as well. So there's a familiarity there. Yeah, I think the tea leaves were pretty clear that he would end up being the new Dolphins head coach. You know, we'll see who he brings in to run the offense. But just to, you know, circle back to the Patriot game, I mean, I genuinely feel bad for every Texans defender, for the defensive coordinator, Matt Burke. It's a Super Bowl caliber defense. They hung in for as long as they could hang. And the fact that they were still a game in the fourth quarter,
yes,
despite all of C.J. Stroud's shortcomings, four first-half interceptions, I thought it was a mistake by D'Amico Ryans not to pull the trigger on a quarterback change and have Davis Mills come out of halftime and see if he could give them a spark, because, you know, Stroud looked lost. He looked scared. I don't know if any of that was true, but he was certainly not playing with any kind of confidence. You knew that he wasn't going to have Nico Collins, so that shouldn't have been a surprise. But losing Dalton Schultz early, I think, was more significant than we probably realized it would be, because he was, in all likelihood, going to be Stroud's security blanket for this game. But no, he looked terrible. You know, you had five fumbles against the Steelers last week, and the defense overcame that. They just couldn't do it 2 weeks in a row. He cost them the game. And it's rare that I say one person costs a team an NFL game, because there's so many elements to the game, so many different plays and moments that impact the outcome in a tight game. But he was solely responsible for why the Texans lost. Because as you guys mentioned, look, the Patriots didn't do much on offense. And yeah, they made some great plays. I got to give Kayshon Boutte a lot of credit. I mean, not only did he make a great catch, maybe two great catches, but he did it against arguably the best cornerback in football, Derek Stingley Jr. So I just thought that he was tremendous. But as a whole, third down offense was terrible, 3 for 14. That's not going to get it done. A little bit of trivia for you. What player is tied for 13th all time in playoff fumbles with 6?
Who?
The answer is Drake May, who's only played 2 playoff games. He's got 6 fumbles. He's lost 3 of them. But that level of play is, you know, that level of play was there for the taking for an opponent to beat a team whose quarterback did not play particularly well for most of that game. Unfortunately for the Texans, C.J. Stroud was so much worse than Drake May was, and that proved costly. But as you said right off the jump, Joe, I couldn't agree with you more. At this stage, you know, the style points are great for podcasts and for, you know, analysts to talk about after the game, but I can guarantee you Mike Vrabel, Drake May, every single person in that locker room couldn't care less. They'll, you know, they'll make the necessary adjustments and try to make the corrections. But all that matters at this stage of the season is, did you win? If you play poorly, hopefully, again, you make the adjustments during the week for the next game. Style points don't matter. Nobody 10 years from now or 5 years from now is going to remember that Nico Collins didn't play. No one's really going to remember that Drake May had, you know, 4 fumbles. Or maybe they might. But, like, for the most part, that stuff gets forgotten. All that gets remembered is that the New England Patriots are in the AFC Championship game.
Yeah, and we made the NCAA tournament reference, right? Survive in advance. Doesn't matter if you're in the number one seed, Kentucky playing friggin' St. Mary's School for the Blind. Like, it doesn't matter. You win by 1 point, you get to the next round. Sorry to step on you there with that breaking news, dude. We do podcasts, so we never get to do shit like that, and we're like having news break all over the place. So like, I had to like itch my news anchor thing right there. But the only silver lining on Drake May, and I think the gotta have it time, the gotta have it plays, I think he's nails. I don't know. There's the touchdown pass between two guys to Diggs. The touchdown pass over the top to Kayshon Boutte, although a great play, I just like how he doesn't want to put the ball in harm's way there. He's like, I'm putting this where Kayshon Boutte can get it or nobody else in the stadium can get it. So I like that decision there. And then there was a couple third down, 3rd and 6, 3rd and 8 that they converted on the last couple drives to one where they kind of run the ball down their throat to kind of get it away from the end zone to pin them back to make sure they don't have a short field. And then the other one, the Diggs in between two guys again, to ice the game there. I just think that there, if you play like that, I think there's a chance you lose to the Broncos. And if you play like that, you will embarrass yourself in the Super Bowl. So there's a lot of things to clean up here. But I think one thing about Drake Mays, he's been improving week to week. It was kind of scary that he didn't do it this week, but I trust that he'll do it from week to week this week. Like I said, you can't play like that and expect to beat the Broncos no matter who's playing at quarterback. Their defense is just as good as the their pass rush, at least, is almost just as good as the Texans. So there's no reprieve coming next week. Dude, can we just talk about the Bears one more time if nobody has anything else left on the this Let's Patriots game, dude? I passed out early and rewatched this game early, but Kayla jumped out of her seat and woke me up during the Caleb Williams play. Like, she's like, did you see that? Did you see how this game ended? So I think that just goes to speak what kind of game that was. It was a perfect scenario for the Bears. It was zero friggin' degrees out. Everybody looked like they were freezing on the Rams side of things. And it brought the game back to them, and it gave Caleb Williams one more chance to make magic. It's all for nothing, though, because they don't end up not winning the game. And the Bears, a kind of magical season comes to an end. One thing I will say is I'm not going to toot my own horn. I definitely think there was chances for them to win this game. I don't think the Rams played as well as they could have. I think they could have played better and put a little bit of distance between themselves and the Bears. But I'm going to keep saying it, man. This does nothing besides help the program for the Bears. They played with who we ranked as one of our best teams through the first 10 weeks of the season. They're on our top five for the last couple weeks of the season after taking a little bit of a dip there. The Bears proved that they can play with some of the best teams in this league, and I think they're going to be a problem and a hard out for seasons to come just based on that coach quarterback combo. You saw the coach put him in the right position, and you saw what magic the quarterback can make at the end of that game. They don't end up coming through, but I don't think it's a negative. I think it's a pretty positive end to a magical season for the Bears.
Yeah, I mean, I could not believe the ending to regulation in this game. I was literally sitting there watching that play. He's running backwards. I think the stats said it was like that ball they need, it was a 14-yard touchdown, right? And it traveled like 50 yards in the air because Caleb Williams ran so far backwards.
When you're just backing up, avoiding the rush, and you just chuck it, dude. Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And, you know, going back to the Rams drive previously, where it was right before the 2-minute warning, and you had 3rd and 10, and it was like 2 minutes and something seconds left, or something like two. I think it was 2 minutes and 2 seconds left. I could not believe why Sean McVay did not try to pick up that first down through the air, where they just handed the ball off a third time, didn't force Ben Johnson to use any more timeouts because the 2-minute warning was there. They obviously didn't get the first down, and they punted the ball back to Caleb Williams. And, you know, we've talked about them being the comeback kids. Like, they had 7 come from behind wins when they were trailing in the last 2 minutes of a game this season, which is unbelievable. And I couldn't for the life of me wonder why they didn't try to let the presumptive MVP quarterback try to win you the game. You know, I thought Sean McVay definitely did not have his best outing, you know, offensively, you know, with the play calling and everything. I don't think they ran the ball enough, especially early in this game. Once they went to the run late,
when their first 40 started to jump in, dude. First 40 plays, 30 passes, 10 rushes, dude. It's 8 degrees out in Chicago in effing January. Put the ball on the ground, dude.
And once he started doing that was when they started scoring points at the end of the game. And, you know, not for nothing, the Rams had the ball first in overtime, and the defense did their job, right? Mm. And there were a couple of stops. I'm trying to remember this correctly, but there were a couple stops in there where the Bears had their opportunity. They had their opportunity. And another thing, I can't for the life of me wonder why DJ Moore stopped running on that play where there was an interception.
Pitiful, dude. Pitiful effort. I've never seen anything worse. Time and place, I've never seen anything worse.
At the end of the day, the better team, like we've been talking about all year, ended up winning this game. And it's going to set up a very, very, very intriguing matchup in the NFC Championship game. I agree with everything you said about the Bears going forward for them.
Yeah, look, I mean, a great season for Chicago. They definitely exceeded my fraudulent, you know, description of them. I was very surprised, frankly, that their defense played as well as they did. Part of that's probably because of what you guys just said. The Bears' weakness on defense. I mean, overall, they're not a particularly good defense, but the most porous part of their defense is their run defense. And Sean McVay, for whatever reason, didn't hammer that home. And McVay did admit after the game it was a poorly coached game. I think it's frankly the worst coach game that I've seen him have in a big spot, and that includes the Super Bowl in which they didn't score a touchdown, but they survived. You know, I agree with what you said, Burge, about the end of regulation. We had talked about that earlier. Third and 10, why not give the likely MVP an opportunity to salt the game away? But then he also, then McVay, you know, also made a mistake in overtime. There's a third and one. They called a pitch play to, I believe, Kyren Williams, lost a couple yards. And for a guy who I believe is, if not the best offensive player caller in football, certainly one of the top two or three, I just thought it was a really poorly coached and thought out game, which is unusual for Sean McVay. And clearly he's going to have to be on his A game against Seattle if they have any designs of going to the Super Bowl. But yeah, that, you know, just getting back to the, you know, the highlight of this game, the Caleb Williams play. What I thought was funny was that it was such an unbelievable play. I was kind of in shock, but there, I was expecting when the ball was in the air to be, you know, some kind of jump ball situation. Maybe a guy's going to be blanketed by two defenders, but he was open by, you know, 2 yards, and it was almost anticlimactic, which is weird because of the amazing play that Williams made to get the ball off. But when it landed in Komet's hand and there was nobody around him, it was almost as if, is there a penalty here? I mean, how did he get so wide open? So great play, probably the most unlikely play that I've ever seen in a playoff spot. I would say it's probably not the best play that I've ever seen. I think that would go to a play, when you look at it initially, it doesn't look that great. But if you look at it on replays on different angles, it was the game-winning touchdown in the Super Bowl from Ben Roethlisberger to Santonio Holmes against the Cardinals. The throw was right over a defender, and the catch was probably the best big game catch I've ever seen in my life. The toe tap in the corner from Santonio Holmes to win the Super Bowl. But, you know, other than that, like this Caleb Williams play, it was something that, you know, Bears fans will be talking about forever, but they'll also be lamenting the fact that they didn't actually win the game.
This was bantied about in my group chat today because I'm a psycho, and that's how I play Madden. Does any part of you want to go for it at the end of regulation there to see if you can win it?
I would not have gone for it. I would have considered it if it was on the road, but you know,
oh, that's a good point. Okay, I agree with that.
The fact that they had, you know, they had the crowd, they had the juice, they had the electricity. And the Rams hadn't really done much in overtime.
And they did have a chance to win in overtime, so you're obviously right there.
Look, hindsight's 20/20, and you know, everybody thinks Ben Johnson, you know, he's a Dan Campbell clone, and he has gone for it so many times, even in this game.
Well, he probably has PTSD from how last year ended, dude.
Yeah, well, you know, it's fascinating because they asked, obviously, after the game, why he didn't go for two. And he had actually a really thoughtful explanation, which was that the goal-to-goal package plays that they had run earlier in the game inside the five were not successful. They ran DeAndre Swift. I don't know if it was Swift or if it was Moore. They ran those guys a couple times. Really no success at all. And so I think that he was a little bit gun-shy. If they had success earlier in the game in those inside-the-five-yard situations, maybe he would have felt emboldened to go for it. But the fact that he clearly pointed out that those, you know, those unsuccessful plays in that area earlier in the game really prompted him to take the PAT, I thought was interesting. You don't usually get answers like that right after a game from coaches, but that clearly colored his perception about whether it would be smart to go for it. But just generally speaking, in that situation, you can't fault him for kicking the extra point. That's, you know, that's really nitpicking, and I think that'd be unfair to Johnson.
Totally, totally agree. I know the Bears had a lot of trouble in short yardage situations in this game, which definitely led to that. I mean, they were 3 of 6, I think, on fourth down. You know, they had a 4th and 1 they were stuffed on, you know, trying to run it too. So, and can you imagine what the narrative would be had he decided to do that and they didn't get it? Like, that would have been, there would have been a lot of negative attention towards the Bears had they not done that. So I totally agree. You kicked the extra point, lived to fight another day there at home.
Yeah. I don't know. I just love stirring the pot and whatever. I imagine that would have been insane if they'd back-to-back plays. Like, you go from having somebody on the ropes, so they throw it out of their butt into the end zone and they go for two. I don't know. Just a quick swing. Do you guys have anything else? I think, dude, I think we've got some, I think the matchup on the matchup on the NFC side is definitely the two best teams in the NFC going at it. I don't know about the Patriots right now with how the friggin' Broncos are currently constituted. It is the 1 or 2 seed, but yeah, I would have loved it. I would have loved Bills Patriots at Gillette. I think that would have been the best story. I think that would have been the best matchup, to be honest. I think that's the two best teams that have the best shot to win the title from the AFC side, coach quarterback wise. Emphasis on the quarterback in Buffalo, obviously, but I think the Seattle Rams game, I cannot wait for that game. I think hopefully that's an all-timer.
I think at the end of the day, you got the two best teams from each conference playing in the championship game. At the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. Obviously, Denver being without Bo Nix is a different story, but the two best teams that we've had ranked all year in our top five, the four best teams in our top five for most of the year are sitting here on Championship Sunday. And I think that the best teams got through to where they should be.
Yeah, I'm with you, Joe. I really want to see Bills Patriots, but now, you know, scared Patriot fans get their wish. They don't get to face Josh Allen. So we'll see how it goes in Denver.
But we knew we were more scared, dude. I'm still not convinced that we're 0-4 in that, dude. We lost to Denver when Peyton Manning was throwing a gallon of paint around, dude. We lost to who was the quarterback during the Champ Bailey game? Jake Plummer, dude, flipping off the stands, flipping off people in the stands and stuff, dude. We cannot win out there. I would way rather, I don't know. It would be fun to do. I know you want Josh Allen to come to Gillette to crush our season himself, but I know
exactly what you wanted.
I also wanted the Patriots to push their little brother back down the stairs one last time.
You guys would know, obviously. I'm pretty sure, but I'm not 100% sure. Wasn't Belichick the head coach when Jared Stidham was drafted?
Yes.
Okay, so how badly do you think that Bill Belichick is rooting for Jared Stidham to stick it to the Patriots in the championship game?
I don't know.
You think he's rooting hard enough to call Sean Payton?
No. I don't know because by the time Jared Stidham time ended in New England, he was pretty much in Bill Belichick's doghouse for taking off to to Texas for a month during right before training camp in the year he was going to be competing for the job.
Yeah.
Right, but you guys
experience. Thanks.
You guys know that Bill Belichick does not want the Patriots to win this game.
No. Did you see him do the? Did you see the Freudian slip he had recently, though?
Yeah,
he was breaking down the Patriots. He accidentally said "we." That's funny. That'd be funny if he gets the Bills job and makes that same slip.
Oh,
again.
My goodness.
Anyway, that has been an episode of the Between the Tackles podcast, divisional round episode, conference championship round episode coming at you next week. We got another interview coming up too. So stick on the socials, follow us, keep up with what we're doing. Goodbye.